ABC Listen. Podcasts, radio, news, music, and more.
Good morning. Welcome to AM. It's Tuesday, January 27th. I'm Isabella Higgins, coming to you from Gadigal Land in Sydney. The remains of the final Israeli hostage held in Gaza have been recovered, more than 2 years after the deadly October 7 attacks. It's a significant moment that could pave the way for the next phase in the fragile ceasefire in the war-ravaged territory. Hamas says it should be the catalyst for Israel to relax some of the restrictions on the Palestinian population. Middle East correspondent Matthew Doran is in Jerusalem. Matthew, take us through the developments of the last few hours.
Isabella, good morning. We know that Israeli forces had been mounting a large-scale search operation in the eastern area of Gaza City, in beyond the so-called yellow line, which is the boundary of the Israeli-controlled territory in Gaza, more than 50% of the strip still within IDF's control there. This search was focused on a cemetery in eastern Gaza around the Shajaiya and Tufa neighbourhoods. And what it's uncovered are the remains of 24-year-old police officer Ran Gvili. Now, he was the last of the hostages. He was killed on October 7, 2023. His body was taken into Gaza and he was never seen again. We now know that he was buried in this cemetery, and in the course of trying to recover his remains, the IDF have effectively dug up 250 bodies, according to the Israeli media. They've tested all of them and they've finally been able to identify Ran Gvili based on dental records there. So quite an extensive operation to try to bring his remains back to Israel. That's something that was a core promise of the Israeli government and of the IDF, to make sure that no hostage was left behind. And of course, it follows the last couple of months or so where we have seen a gradual retrieval of a number of the remains of dead hostages. There were 28 dead hostages in Gaza at the time of the ceasefire being struck back in October. There were 20 living hostages then as well. Those living hostages were rescued almost immediately, but the dead hostages, it's taken some time. What this will now trigger is also the release by Israeli authorities of the bodies of a number of Palestinians who have been held for some time, and more than a dozen bodies expected to be handed over as a result.
A significant moment, but Matthew, what does this mean for the next stages of the ceasefire?
Well, it might mean that there is a bit more progress on those next phases of this very fragile truce. We know that Israel has long said it wouldn't do things such as opening the Rafah border crossing between Gaza and Egypt without that final set of remains being handed over by Hamas. And Hamas has said, as a result of this discovery, it is insisting that it had helped authorities to recover Ran Gvili, and it had, as a result, it believes that there needs to be an effort to open that border crossing, and that a number of other countries, particularly the US, need to pressure Israel to do so. We also know that there are other issues that need to be figured out with regards to this ceasefire, such as the demilitarization of Gaza, Hamas laying down its weapons, and efforts to ensure that Israel is also withdrawing from more territory in Gaza, as it still holds more than 50% of the area there. So it is a significant moment, and it may well spell a bit more progress there, but we do need to stress that this is still far from sorted, and that over the course of the last couple of months there has been a significant amount of military activity still. Palestinian health authorities saying more than 480 Palestinians and more than 1,300 Palestinians have been either killed or injured, 480 killed, 1,300 injured as a result of Israeli strikes, as Israel claimed Hamas was breaching this ceasefire over the course of the last few months.
Middle East correspondent Matthew Doran. US President Donald Trump says he's spoken to the Minnesota governor about working together after the second fatal shooting by immigration officers in the state. The death of ICU nurse and American citizen Alex Pretty has prompted deep anger and upset. As authorities begin their investigation, a judge is also weighing up the state's request to end the surge of federal immigration agents. Let's go to our correspondent Rachel Clayton in Washington. Rachel, the Trump administration says there is now an open investigation into Alex Pretty's killing. Tell us what we know.
That's right. So according to court records that we've seen this morning, Homeland Security is going to be taking the lead in this investigation into the fatal shooting of Alex Pretti in Minneapolis just a few days ago. The investigation is being called a review of a use of force encounter. It's something the FBI would actually usually handle, but they've now handed over all their evidence to Homeland Security, including Mr. Pretty's mobile phone and his gun. But there's not a lot of trust from the state and state officials that this is going to be a fair investigation, given Kristi Noem, who's the Homeland Security Secretary, has already said that Mr. Pretty was at fault here. She's called him a domestic terrorist and someone who was intent on hurting Border Patrol agents when there was that clash that we've all seen the video of. There's also been no talk of appointing an independent investigator, so someone outside of the state and federal government to come in and do this. But going forward, Homeland Security is going to be taking charge. And we also heard from Carolyn Leavitt, the press secretary, this morning about this, and she's had more to say on her judgment, I guess, and the doubling down from federal officials of how they view the state of Minnesota and how they've been helping or hindering that investigation.
As the duly elected president, the president is fulfilling the will of the people by arresting and removing these threats from our country in cities from Los Angeles to New York and, yes, Minneapolis. Yet Democrat leaders in Minnesota with sanctuary city policies have actively defied federal immigration law and the will of the people. And as a result of that defiance, two Minnesotans have now tragically lost their lives on the streets of Tim Walz's state. It is President Trump's hope and wish and demand for the resistance and chaos to end today. That's why President Trump spoke with Governor Walz directly this morning, and he has outlined a clear and simple path to restoring law and order in Minnesota.
Rachel, there's also an important legal case. What's the update on that?
There are actually two court cases going on, but the main one is whether a federal judge will decide to kick ICE out of Minnesota. So the state has argued this morning that the immigration enforcement operation is so big now that it is violating the state's sovereignty under the 10th Amendment. They say that the lawyers for the state and the city want the judge to stop the unlawful and unchecked invasion. That's what one of the lawyers have said, of federal agents. Judge Kate Menendez is the one who's going to rule on this. She did question during the hearing this morning whether she was the one who could decide when federal law enforcement crosses the line from being what she called a legitimate law enforcement response to a response that violates the 10th Amendment. She was quite skeptical and questioned the state lawyers quite a lot on what evidence they had that instead of bringing individual cases of violations to a court, they were trying to bring all of them into this one big case now to kick out ICE. So she hasn't made a decision yet, but she said she's going to try and make one as quickly as she can.
Correspondent Rachel Clayton in Washington. The family of a woman who died in a Northern Territory police watchhouse last month are still searching for answers. They want to know why she wasn't checked by medical staff over nearly 2 days and want changes implemented to prevent more Indigenous deaths in custody. Jane Barden reports.
Liz Dempsey is holding on to the happy memories she has of her niece, Kumanjay Dempsey.
She was just a kind-hearted person and soft and happy.
The death of the 44-year-old mother of five in the Tennant Creek Watch House on the 27th of December has rocked her family.
The devastation that's left behind with her gone, there's no healing from it. And this is something we don't heal from, you know, and it's still happening to my family from when it happened before.
It's the second death in custody the family have suffered. Another of Liz Dempsey's nieces died by suicide in child protection in Darwin in 2014.
It was a big shock. You know, here's one of ours, again, dying in custody.
The NT police say Kumanjay Dempsey died in Tennant Creek's watch house after a medical episode, almost 2 days after being arrested for aggravated assault. Liz Dempsey says her niece had rheumatic heart disease. Police say she didn't tell officers she was ill.
She should have been seen to. If it wasn't that day, at least try for the next day.
Unlike all other major NT towns, Tennant Creek didn't have a watch house custody nurse to check her health. despite this being recommended by a coronial inquiry in 2012.
You know, as all the other areas have got it, why haven't Tennant Creek got it? And they failed in their duty of care to my niece, and they need to be held accountable for it.
Indigenous justice and health groups think a watch house nurse could have prevented the death. The chief executive of the North Australian Aboriginal Justice Agency, Ben Grimes, says the government should hire a nurse now.
We know everything we need to know to be able to say this is the right response, and so it should be actioned immediately.
The NT government says it won't make any changes until coronial investigations conclude. Unlike nurses, police can't access health records. But the NT Health Minister, Steve Edgington, says police can call on medical staff.
The hospital itself is very close by to the watch house in Tennant Creek. Where there are clearly identified medical issues, there's the ability for police to take that person to the hospital.
Another measure meant to help prevent deaths is a requirement all Aboriginal people arrested get to call a 24/7 Indigenous Legal Service hotline called the Custody Notification Service. The lawyers can then tell the police about any health concerns they've missed. Nadja CEO Ben Grimes.
Often people in custody don't like speaking directly to police, but they'll give that information to us and ask us to tell the police.
Client confidentiality means the legal service can't disclose whether this happened or not in Kumanjay Dempsey's case. The NT police have declined further comment while they investigate the death. Liz Dempsey is dismayed Australia's Indigenous deaths in custody reached an all-time high of 33 last year, despite hundreds of Royal Commission and coronial inquiry recommendations.
What have they put in place from that? Still, our people are dying in jails.
She wants coronial recommendations following her niece's death listened to.
Make sure they happen. Don't just put it on a piece of paper and then let it fly away.
Kumanjay Dempsey's aunt, Liz Dempsey, speaking to Jane Barton there. The government agency that presided over the robo-debt scandal has again been found in breach of the law. A scathing report by the Federal Ombudsman has found the Department of Social Services deliberately broke laws relating to child support payments for 6 years. On top of that, the report reveals the agency failed to escalate significant issues to government. Here's political reporter Sarah Tomevska.
In 2019, Services Australia, also known as Centrelink, flagged issues with new child support legislation that had inadvertently made some parents with minimal caring duties eligible for child support payments. The law went against long-standing government policy that any parent with less than 35% care of a child is not eligible for support. Services Australia chose not to comply with the law, concerned it would have unfair outcomes for single parents. A year later, the Department of Social Services was informed.
Well, the agencies decided early on that the best thing to do was to have the legislation changed to correct these unintended errors in the legislation. But the thing is that it never actually progressed, and we're now 6 years on and it still hasn't been fixed.
That's Commonwealth Ombudsman Ian Anderson, who says the agencies failed to take appropriate steps to alert relevant ministers. In a report released today, he's compared the department's inaction to its handling of the robo-debt scandal.
Well, the thing that links these is they both involve public servants deciding that they don't need to comply with the law.
But there is a significant difference.
Here, that the agencies were motivated by valid and proper and understandable concerns that it would have the wrong impacts on people. But still, it's not a public servant's ability to choose whether they're going to comply with the law.
Around 600,000 parents access child support payments. Therese Edwards from Single Mother Families Australia says the blunder could impact community trust in the system.
Child support is known as a system that can be weaponised. And of course, then we've got all the loopholes and the minimisation. We don't want a system to be interpreted. We really want the system to be known and to offer certainty.
Services Australia alerted the Ombudsman of the issue in July, but ministers were only briefed late last year. The Albanese government says it will introduce corrective legislation when Parliament returns in February. In a statement, a spokesperson said the Albanese government is committed to ensuring the child support scheme operates in the best interests of children, adding, "It's a long-standing principle of the child support scheme that parents with less than 35% care of a child should not be eligible." The Ombudsman has also issued 6 recommendations to the Department and Services Australia, all of which have been accepted.
Both those two agencies, to be fair, have done a lot to change their culture and to change the way they identify and respond to issues. But I do think there's something here for every public servant to look at. If you see something that you think the legislation is not working, you need to do something about it and escalate that quickly.
That's Ombudsman Ian Anderson ending that report by Sarah Tomevska. It's time for kids to head back to the classroom, and the new school year should bring with it a new approach to bullying. Soon, teachers will be expected to take action within 2 days of a complaint as part of a new government anti-bullying plan. Isabel Misali reports.
Jodie Carter's son Hamish died by suicide in 2022. He was 12 and had been bullied for half his life.
He was, you know, such a happy, little, clever, loving, little, gorgeous boy, but he started getting picked on by some kids in the primary school years. And then, yeah, over time, lost all of his confidence, became withdrawn, and then his mental health suffered.
She made a submission last year to an anti-bullying review, along with more than 1,700 students, families and education professionals. Professor Jo Robinson is the review co-chair and head of suicide prevention research at youth organisation Origin.
We did hear a really strong commitment to tackling this problem, and we really hope this can be a national reset. The review is there.
And education ministers will meet next month to consider how to implement its recommendations this year, with $10 million already allocated.
Governments have made a commitment to a campaign, a national campaign, which is really around, I think, building awareness and educating people around what bullying is, how to report bullying.
She also expects trauma-informed training for school staff and better record keeping of bullying incidents. Another key recommendation is for schools to initiate a response to an incident within 2 days.
We really did hear the need for people to feel heard and for safety and well-being to be put in place, so a young person feels safe going to school once they've made a report of bullying. So we can certainly expect to see schools kind of taking that on board and starting to look at ways to implement that recommendation.
The Australian Education Union last year welcomed the changes, but cautioned teachers need more support and adequate resourcing. Dr. Paul Kidson says most schools already act on issues promptly. He's an associate professor in educational leadership at the Australian Catholic University and a former principal.
Sometimes an allegation, when it's reported, can need a little bit of investigation, and that may not necessarily be able to take place entirely within 2 days. So it would be a reasonable expectation then for a parent or caregiver to get contact from the school to say, look, we are investigating, this is where we're up to, but it is going to take a little bit of time. And I think that's going to be a really important communication priority for this new policy. It's not that the issues will be resolved in 2 days, but there needs to be some action.
He says parents also need to consider how they respond if their child is bullying others.
For parents or caregivers to take a blanket position to say, my child's not had the chance of even done anything wrong, is not a healthy and constructive way. It may not be a nice thing to get a phone call from the school that your child has been accused of doing certain behaviours, but that needs to be an open conversation between parents and caregivers, between the school, and to do so in a cooperative and productive way.
Mother Jodie Carter hopes one day she'll tell her son's story at schools, but she also wants a more compassionate approach towards both sides.
The bullies don't. They need to be sorted out as well. So somebody needs to actually speak to them and find out what's going on in their life, which makes them want to bully.
Education Minister Jason Clare was unavailable for an interview, but said in a statement that the National Anti-Bullying Plan is part of a big year for education that also includes numeracy and phonics assessments for year ones.
Isabel Massali reporting, and if you or anyone you know needs help, you can call Kids Helpline on 1800 55 1800. And that's AM for today. Thanks for your company. I'm Isabella Higgins.
Hi, it's Sam Hawley here, host of the ABC News Daily podcast. Donald Trump's approach to Greenland might be erratic, but it's all in line with his foreign policy aim to reorder the world. Today, Monica Duffy-Toft, Professor of International Politics at the Fletcher School at Tufts University, on Trump's bid to control the Western Hemisphere. Look for the ABC News Daily podcast on the ABC Listen app.